Melachim Aleph, Perek Hey, Pasuk Aleph. Shloimo Yamoshel Bechol Amlochis Min Anor Eretz Plishtim Ve'ad Gvul Mitzrayim Magishim Mincha Ve'oyvdim Shloimo Kol Yemechayav. So Shloimo, once he established his monarchy, he was able to control not only the Jewish people, but he controlled all the nations surrounding him. First of all, he had David HaMelech, his father, who fought the wars before him, and he set, you know, he really set the premise where everyone was terrified to start up with any Jewish king, because they remembered David. Secondly, even though Shlomo himself did not fight really that many wars, we'll see that later on he fought the Tifsach. What was it? It was Hamas Tzeva and Etzion Gover. Those were small wars that he did fight. But generally, he didn't really need to fight that much. He was pretty much all set. However, even though he did not fight that many wars, he still had a very large army. We're going to see later on exactly how big his army was. Now, in order to a lot of what Shlomo did was not necessarily just what he needed, but he really added more, you know, for the prestige and for the honor of his kingship. So that's why he had a very large feast every single day, and people used to come from all over to join him. His palace was open to everybody. Anyone who wanted to come could join him, and the Poskever describes how big it was. So let's see. The amount of bread he had each day was 30 kor seilos or 60 kor kemach, which was a huge amount. So he had tons of bread. Asar bakar brim, he had 10 cows that were shechted every day. Vesrim bakar rei u'me'a tzoyin, right? 20 calves and 100 sheep. Levad Mayal Tzviv Yachmur or Barburim Avusim. Right, he had all these animals. The menu was, you can imagine, what kind of you had on the menu. All these different meats, different cuts, animals, ducks, and Barburim, swans. It was
a swan kosher.
Yeah. Barbur is a swan. Apparently it is kosher. I don't know why we don't eat swans today. According to the Mitzvah in Barburim are
geese.
And he says that it's they're birds that come from the land of Barbaria. Barbaria. I don't know what that is. Barbaria? Ever heard of that place?
Not yet. No. I wasn't there lately.
I haven't been there now.
I haven't got a passport.
No. Okay. According to the Radak, it doesn't necessarily mean a certain type of bird. Rather, it's just referring to how fat and they used to fatten up the birds. That's what it's referring to.
I mean, why is it important to know all this stuff?
Because we're setting the stage for the kingship of Shlomo. So we're describing how prestigious and honorable it was. And the fact that he had so much food at his table every single day shows that, you know, he was definitely a very, very important king. Right? No. It was for everybody. His palace was open to anybody who wanted to come and join him. People used to come from all over to come and join him.
Well, he says, one place they say that he was, he ruled the whole world.
Yeah.
But
eventually.
He said, no, actually, he didn't at all work, because there were other kings, King Pharaoh and another couple, but
right.
They all pay tribute to him.
Yeah.
So it's 10 fat oxen. That's get them up.
That's a lot of oxen. That's for sure.
20 oxen out of the pasture, out of the sheep. Hots, dear fellow, dear, better all, race. But they keep all this stuff.
Well, he had a lot of land.
He has to have a big ranch.
Yeah. We're going to see exactly, actually, the pasuk describes exactly how many stables he had for his horses. His horses were a big issue. Okay, we'll see. We'll get there. Let's not jump the gun. So let's continue. Pasuk Dalet. Ki roi de b'chol ever hanar mitifsach bad aza b'chol malchi ever hanar v'shalom ha'yaloi mikol avarav misavi. He ruled over all the over all the kings that surrounded him. And that's, by the way, why he had so much food at his table. Where did all these animals come from? All the kings that were surrounding Eretz Yisrael used to bring him animals, as you know, that back in the day. They didn't bring these like fancy pens or you know, whatever it was,
or a watch.
The way they would show respect was bringing animals as tribute. And that's why he had all these different animals from all these interesting countries. Like, according to the Mitzvah de Sion, he had these birds from Barbaria, wherever that was. And the Radak explains, that's what you were saying before, that Tifsach and Aza are countries that are at the end of the world. The two countries that are literally at the end of the world. Right? So according to one pshat, Tifsach was on one end of the world, and Aza was on the other end of the world. According to another pshat, they were actually right next to each other. But what they were saying is that, like surrounding the whole globe like that, like, you know, like both have like, you know, all the countries surrounding him until those two countries of Tifsach and Aza on the other side of the globe. And just like he ruled on Tifsach and Aza, so too he ruled over the whole world. Okay. Ve'eshev Yehuda Yisrael of Betach, Ishtach Zgafnai Betach Zdeinosai, Midan Vat Be'er-Sheva, Kol Yemei Shleim. Everyone sat comfortably, they didn't have to worry about wars, they didn't have to worry about Parnasa, they had everything they needed. Ve'eshev Shleim Arbaim Elef Urvois Susim Lemarkovai, Shneimasar Elef Paroshim. Now this turned into a big issue. So first of all, let's figure out how many horses he had. So it says here that he had 40,000 stables to ride on, and 12,000 horsemen. Now it says, Chazal say that Shlomo was over on the Avera, which says Lo Yarbalesus. A king should not have too many horses.
Yeah.
What's the issue with that? So the Radak explains that, listen, there's no problem if the king has horses if he actually uses them. If he needs them, fine. You know, if he needs them to fight the wars. The problem is, the issue only arises when he has what's called a susim batalim, horses that are not used for anything, or they're just sitting in the stables doing absolutely nothing, right? Drinking and eating and having a good time. That's the problem. So it says there in the pasuk that he had what? He had 12,000 horsemen. So if he had 12,000 horsemen, what does he need 40,000 horses for? All right, the rest of the horses, 22,000, are sitting there doing nothing.
It says it has 40,000 stalls of horses.
Right, so
there might be more horses than 40,000. You get 40,000 stalls. Each stall has a few horses.
The problem is it's a stira between this Navi Malachim and Divrei Hayomim. In Divrei Hayomim it says that he has 4,000. And over here it says he has 40,000. So in order to explain the discrepancy, the Mefarshim explained that really he had 4,000 stables and he had 40,000 horses. Yeah, that's how they explain that.
It sounds more plausible.
Yeah. 40,000 stables is a lot. You know, every stable you have, I don't know.
Who's going to be the manager?
Yeah.
He has some stables up the north.
Yeah, he had them all over Israel.
At Tavor, someplace, I remember.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the exact location.
Many years ago, all right.
But in any case, even though, again, he didn't have any wars, so why did he have so many horses? Again, for the same reason, for prestige, for honor.
Well, actually, He probably brought it to him. He didn't go after him. If they brought him all the other stuff, they brought him horses,
for sure.
Too.
For sure. For sure, no question. Yeah, so that became a real issue. We're going to see later on.
Did he actually himself ride a chariot?
Yeah.
I mean, he never went to war.
Right? Right, he never went to war, but still, you know, when the king's not going to come out, you know,
well,
riding by
he
himself.
Sat around in his house, and he wrote till him.
Well, it was David Melech who wrote tell him, but we'll see. He wasn't bored, you know, don't worry. He kept himself busy. Let's see what he says. V'chiliko la nitzavim ha'eles ha'melech shlaimah v'skol ha'karev el shulchan ha'melech shlaimah ish chodshay lo ya'ad rudover. Remember, last week we explained that Shlaimah Melech had 12 officials. Each one of them was in charge over 1 month. So again, there was one Shevet, right? 12 Shvatim. One Shevet was in charge to support the king for 1 month of the year. The rest of the 11 months, they're exempt. So now, each official was in charge of one shevet to make sure that they would pay their taxes. But that they would not only support Shlomo financially, they would support everyone who came and joined his table. V'asoirim v'atevin l'susim v'larechesh yaviu elal ha'makam asher yisham ish kemishpatai. Right, they were in charge not only over Shlomo's lunch, that was huge, but they were in charge over the horses as well. We see the horses were a big deal back in the day to make sure that they had everything they needed. Okay, so let's see weiter. Beitan alakim chokhma l'shnoyme utvuna harbe ma'id v'roichav leiv kachol asher asfas hayom. And again, so this is a bit repetitive. We already mentioned that Hashem gave Shlomo wisdom. But now we're actually specifying what kind of wisdom Shlomo HaMelech actually had. So let's see. So the Radak explains there that when it describes his wisdom, it says, "Kachol asher asfas hayam." He had as much wisdom as the grains on the beach. Right, and then it says, "Roch of Lev." So we're saying like this. The Radak explains that just like the sand is a fence, so to speak, around for the ocean, that the ocean won't come onto the land. So too, the Chochma was a fence to Shlomo, meaning he had a vast, vast amount of knowledge. It was as big as the ocean. And the Reich of Lev is referring to the different topics, the different areas in which he had his wisdom. It wasn't only specified to one area. We're saying his wisdom was greater than Chochavas Bnei Kedem. Bnei Kedem is referring to the people who live in the east, probably Asians, I'm assuming. They're known to be very, very, very wise. They can tap into the mazalos, right? The twelve mazalos that are on the year. What's the word in English?
Signs of the zodiac.
Yeah, right.
Mazel galgal.
Yeah. So and like as you mentioned before, Mitzrayim was also a main source of wisdom back in the day. So he was wiser than all of those.
Here he says that it's the sand that is on the seashore. He says, just as the sand is on the sea, is the boundary which stops and controls the oceans, so also did Solomon's wisdom guide and control his feelings and desires.
Mm.
He controlled himself.
Yeah.
I mean, they like... if he was going to do something wrong, something grabs hold of him and mm-hmm. stops him. Just like in the shore,
yeah.
the water gets stopped in the thing.
Right. Right.
But right. He brings down on and say he knew everything, but he lost some of it when he married the non-Jewish women.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Why would you do such a thing? But that's another bit. That's another book.
Right. So the Malbim explains here that the Chochmas Mitzrayim is referring to the wisdom of the Egyptians was, as we see in Egypt, that they were able to control magic and witchcraft.
Yeah.
They were able to change things, change objects to look into to turn into something else. Right, and so he was even wiser than all of that, meaning he controlled all these different types of wisdom. The next pasuk, Yud Aleph, Vayechem kol ha'odom me'etan ha'ezrachi v'heman v'chalkol v'darda b'nei machol v'yishmoi v'chol ha'goyim saviv. It says he was wiser than all laundry list of people. So who are these people? Who are they referring to? So the Radak explains exactly who they are. And it says, "Vayechem mikol ha'adam." It's not referring to all the human beings. It's referring to Adam Harishain, who was a very wise man. He was even wiser than Adam Harishain. Eitan ha'ezrachi is referring to Avraham Avinu. It says, "Maskil Eitan ha'ezrachi." Right now, what was the wisdom of Adam Harishain? Adam Harishain, we know, was able to call the animals with their names. By their name, right? And that apparently was a great chachmah. He had insight into what the essence of the animal was all about. Based on that, he gave each animal its name. So clearly, Adam Harishon was a very wise man, and Shlomo was wiser than Adam Harishon. Eitan Ezrachi, again, is Avraham Avinu. Heman is referring to Moshe. Meloshon Ne'eman. It says B'chol Beisi Ne'eman. Who? That's Hashem describing Moshe Rabbeinu. Chalkol is referring to Yosef, because it says by Yosef, if I chalkol Yosef, eskol Eretz Mitzrayim. Yosef provided sustenance to all the land, to the whole land of Egypt. So this is Yosef. B'nei Machol. Sorry, Darda is referring to Dor Dea. Dor Dea is Dor Midbar, who were able to see Hashem. It says, "Bras Shivcha Yam Ashalai Ra Yecheskel Ben Buzi." Yecheskel Ben Buzi was the greatest prophet who ever lived, and even the simple Jew was able to see on the shores of the Red Sea what Yecheskel ben Buzi, the greatest prophet, never saw.
What is this? At the end, he says he was wiser than all men. Then Eitan the Ezrite. Who's?
That's Avraham Avinu. That's what I'm just explaining. Eitan Ezrachi is Avraham Avinu.
Oh.
Right? Because it says masculine Eitan Ezrachi. And that's referring to Avraham Avinu. Yeah, again, Haman is Moshe. Right? In the pasuk says Haman. That's Moshe, because it says B'chol Beisi Ne'eman Hu. Chalkol is Yosef, because it says V'chalkol Yosef. Darda is Dardea. And B'nei Machol is, again, Dardea, the Dar Midbar. Why are they called B'nei Machol? Shenimcha lehem Maise Ha'egel. The Maise of the Egel was forgiven to them. They were pardoned for the Egel. They do appear somewhere else. That's how we know who they are. A lot of them are just like similar names, like Haman is Moshe, because it says B'chol Beisi Ne'emanu. Haman comes from the word Ne'eman, loyal. And it says B'chol Beisi Ne'emanu.
Not directly say.
Right. Why doesn't it say their actual name? That's a good question. I don't know. It's a good question. Maybe not to embarrass them. Not to put them down. Because we're saying, oh, Shlomo was so wise, he was wiser than all this laundry list of people. So we don't want to put them down and say, oh, you know, Shlomo was wiser than you. So it says it in a hinting way. Okay, let's see next. Avidav Shloisha Salafim Mashal, he composed 3,000 analogies. Vahishirei Chamisha V'Aleph. He also composed all these songs, which is Shir HaShirim was really his main song. That's why it was chose to be Shir HaShirim. Right, Shir HaShirim was divided into 5 chapters. That's why it says Chamisha. Right? And the Aleph is referring to the end of Shir HaShirim, which the last paragraph starts, "Achoyis l'nuktana v'shadayim ein lo." It says, "Aleph l'choshleima nikra shir aleph." It's referring to the song of 1,000. So again, shir shirim. This is referring to shir shirim. According to the Radak, the reason why it says that he had 3,000 was because every single pasuk has 2 or 3 ta'amim. 2 or 3 explanations. So that's how you get to 3,000.
My bubby used to sing Shir HaShirim and translate.
Oh yeah, should I actually sing it?
Did you ever hear it? Shir HaShirim, this is the gazing of Shlomo HaMelech gazingen, is given the shensta and the best in the ganze Welt. That's all I remember.
That's all you remember?
Yeah.
Must have been a great song.
So there was more to it than just, you know, a couple of words, you know, it's all
yeah, it was all a song.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Let's see next pasuk. Vaydaber al ha'itzim min ha'erez asher b'al avonayin v'ad ha'ezav asher yoytza b'kir vaydaber al ha'behima v'al ha'if al ha'remes v'al ha'dogim. So it says where he spoke about the trees, about the Erez, and about the Ezav. What is that referring to? So the Malbim explains, the Radak explains that what it's referring to is referring to Taras. He was able to explain why someone who's coming to purify himself from Taras, from leprosy, has to bring a carbon from Erez, which is the tallest tree, and from an Ezav, which is the smallest possible, growth that you can grow. So why is that? So he explained that because he raised himself to the heights of an Erez, because he was very haughty, he was very arrogant, that's why he got Saras. That's why he brings an Erez, which is the tallest tree. But then, in order to cure himself, because he was able to lower himself as low as Ezav, which is the smallest weed that you can grow. That's how he was able to cure himself. That's pshat in Vaydabar La'itim. And then it says Vaydabar.
What do you mean? Who got Saras?
No, I'm saying he's just referring. So explained the whole idea of Taras, what it's all about. That's what it means that he spoke about the trees. What does he mean he spoke about the trees?
Not somebody actually got it. He's talking about how it comes and
yeah,
how it goes away.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Hypothetically. And then it says, V'edar b'ala b'hema b'ala oif, v'ala remes, v'ala dogi. What that means, the Radak explains, that's referring to, he explained why a behema, in order to shecht a behema, for kosher slaughter, you need to cut both simanim, the trachea and the esophagus. However, for an oif, you only need one. You only need one siman, right? You should know this, Richard. Are you a sheikhet? No, you're not a sheikhet. Okay, but in any case, he explained why the behemah needs both simanim in order to be kosher, and the oif, a chicken, any type of bird, only needs one siman in order to be kosher. Vala remes, that's referring to the shemayna shratzim, that are brought down in the Torah. why anyone who hunts them and who hits them, which causes them to bleed, is chayav. It's referring to Shabbos. And why in some situations on Shabbos you would be chayav, but other shratzim, your potter, if you hit them on Shabbos and the blood clot forms because they have skin. And these eight shratzim that are brought down on the Torah do not have skin. Therefore, if the blood clot forms, it's nothing. You're not chayav. Dagim, finally, explains why any animal requires kosher slaughter, kosher shechita, in order to be eaten. And dagim fish are not required any shechita in order to be eaten. You can eat them the second they come out of the water. People gathered from all over to come hear the wisdom, the great wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech, because the stories, and amongst them the story of the two women that we saw last week, they heard that, and that's why they came to come listen.
I think I saw someplace that he didn't, not talking to a tree, but where to plant the tree, where's the best place, where's the best soil, when you should plant it, when you should fertilize it, when you should water it. And even with the animals, how to, you know, what's
how to train
the best
them.
Way to, yeah, train them, feed them, you know, keep them healthy. And
interesting.
Yeah. It says Hiram was Yehuda's father-in-law. It says some people say he lived 1,200 years.
1,200 years?
You didn't get that
years?
Far yet.
Yeah.
1,200 years, that's...
It's a lot,
nobody,
yeah.
Nobody lived more than... more than the before 969.
Right.
Methuselah.
Yeah.
So...
And I come to see...
Yeah.
You come out of the Xavier was... 1,000 years.
That young, what?
Then it got smaller and smaller, even the one...
Yeah,
Odom gave away 70 years, so he was 9, but
yeah,
it's a long time.
Yeah, it's a
he
long time.
He never got old.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's see. Vayitor ve'ishlach chir ha'melech tzar es avodov el shloima ki shama ki oisem moshech ha'melech tachas avihu ki oyev ha'chir ha'modovid kol yomim. So now we are starting. This is the initial. Process to building the Beis HaMikdash. So Hiram, who was a very close ally of David HaMelech, heard that Shlomo now became king, and he realized that Shlomo would be the one to build the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore he sends not only the materials, but he even recruits his own men to work in order to cut down these trees. Apparently in his land there were these perfect trees that were just right for the Beis HaMikdash. So he made some kind of agreement with Shlomo that Shlomo would support them. He would give them everything they needed to eat and drink, all the accommodations, and he would supply the labor force. So he got his own men, Hiram, even though these men were not Jewish, but they helped with the effort of building the Beis HaMikdash. So they would cut down these trees. And the way they brought down the way they sent the trees over was after they cut down the trees and they got rid of all the branches, they cut off all the branches and everything. After they finished, they went ahead and they created a raft from these trees. They sent these rafts over on the ocean all the way to Eretz Yisrael. Remember, Eretz Yisrael has plenty of ports. It's right on the ocean. So it's very easy to get the trees, to get these tree trunks. And after they got to Eretz Yisrael, they would take apart these rafts, and that's how they would deliver these trees all the way to Yerushalayim and use them to build the Beis HaMikdash. That was the system that they did, they worked on. They had a very interesting system, just if you think about it. Like, you know, they didn't have, obviously, modern technology. They didn't have any trucks. They didn't have these cranes. They were able to carry these, you know, these heavy rocks. If you ever go to the Kaisel, you'll see that, you know, the stones that were used to build the Kaisel are huge. They're humongous.
Because it's, you know, as long as the room.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they're huge. How were they able to deliver these huge stones all the way? They used to they used to dig around the stone, however big it was. They would make, you know, kind of like a hole, and then they would carve it out, literally carve it out from the earth. And as they would bring it up, how would they, you know, this was all the way.
How do they get them up on anything? To schlep them.
Yeah, exactly. So there were many different theories as to what exactly, what technology they used in order to bring them all the way to Yerushalayim.
Well, first of all, they had to get the stones the one that split the stones. They weren't allowed to. They didn't know how to use any hammers or anything to knock the stones.
That was only in Yerushalayim.
They had what's the name? What they called? What was
the one?
The one who broke the stones.
Shamir.
The chisel? What?
Like no, he's talking about a Shamir.
The Shamir, yeah, yeah.
What
the worm, yeah.
What's the name?
Shamir.
Shamir. Then how do you pick it up?
Right.
That was only in Yerushalayim. Up in the quarries, they didn't do that.
Right. While they were building the Beis Hamikdash, there was no noise that was supposed to be heard. And because it wasn't like a construction site where you hear like you know, these drills and these tractors, you know, going on. It's not honorable. It's not covered for the Beis Hamikdash. If you have all this commotion, all this hustling and bustling, and it looks like a construction site. So everything was brought to the Beis Hamikdash. Fully completed, right? They didn't even use hammers. They weren't allowed to use hammers at all. They didn't use any nails, so we're going to see later on exactly how they put everything together. But, so how do they bring these huge stones that were enormous, without any cranes, without any trucks, without anything? So there are many, many theories over the years that were given as to exactly how they were brought over, but one of the theories I heard recently got strengthened was that they took wood and they built kind of like a pathway on the wood, kind of like a dock, and they would use these tiny little balls, and they actually found these balls in archaeological diggings. They found these tiny little balls, and they would put these stones that were very, very heavy, but because they had all these balls, tiny balls, like, not that big at all.
Bearings.
Yeah. They would actually put tons of them under this rock, and because there were so many of them, they were easily able to push the
water. How did they get them under it?
No, they would pick it.
The stones on the ground, how did they get the balls under?
No, they wouldn't. No, they would pick it up. Obviously, they would have to pick it up off the ground.
How did they pick it up?
No, they would put ropes under the stone. That's not the issue. The issue is
stone? I mean, it's the same question.
You get 20 men on each side.
20 men?
Yeah.
You get a stone like a talk, but 20 men ain't going to pick it up.
You don't think?
No.
Okay, I don't know how they picked it up.
All right.
I don't know.
I can understand the ball. You'll be rolling along.
Yeah, but so yeah, they used to pull these tiny little balls all across.
You have to be able to put them out so that you're able to roll along. The same thing, be able to pick it up and put it on a wagon so you can transport it.
No wagon would be able to hold that.
All right, but whatever.
The wheels, yeah. But in any case, that's apparently how they brought these stones all the way to the...
Maybe they had Og Melech HaBoshen and he picked them up.
Yeah. Okay, we'll stop here. We'll continue next time.